Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hi there, marvelous audience. It's Peter Bregan, and I'm just delighted to be talking to you as I do every week at this time. We've got 48,000 downloads on this show now. We're doing good. I'm very proud of the audience, and just look forward to growing the audience. Tell folks about it. Tell them what wonderful guests we have here. I'm at home nursing a cold. I don't know if I sound any different. My phone line may sound a little different because I'm not at my office with my high-tech Skyping equipment and my super microphone. I'm talking to you on a hard line. We might have some glitches along the way since I can't instant message back and forth with my marvelous engineer, Giselle. But I suspect this will be glitchless today, as always, pretty much. My guest today, before I tell you anything about him, I'm going to tell you what he's written on Mad in America, because then it's a little surprising in some ways about who he is in terms of his background. All right, on Mad in America, he's got one blog up that's entitled, So They Say Your Child Has ADHD, April Fools. Wish I'd written that one. And he's got ADHD, Bigfoot, and the Missing Links in Research. ADHD diagnosis is a war of semantics waged on children. He's really got away with words. Welcome to Planet ADHD, a farce to be reckoned with. Now, my guest, and you are there, I hope, Michael.
I am, sir.
My guest is Michael W. Corrigan. He has a new book out, which fits with these blogs, Debunking ADHD, 10 Reasons to Stop Drugging Kids for Acting Like Kids. So let me tell you that again and take some of the weight off of him for having to push his book, because I push his book. It's a good book. It's a good introductory book to these issues. It's a good book for folks who don't want to read, you know, deep research and other issues. It's informed by research, but it's an easy book to read. Debunking ADHD, 10 Reasons to Stop Drugging Kids for Acting Like Kids, Roman and Littlefield, and it actually comes out just about today. Just about today. Michael Corrigan is, to begin with, a tenured professor at Marshall University, and he has been doing research in education and writing in the field of education for a long time. He has gotten educational grants from the Department of Education to do studies in 5-6 different states. He's had National Science Foundation grants. He's even had Department of Justice grants. He is the author of a book on multidimensional education, a common sense approach to data-driven thinking. And he's the co-author, I think, of a handbook of pro-social education. This is a very solid research background. It's a very solid institutional background. It's not the background, generally speaking, of somebody who has these kind of breakout, marvelous titles and who takes on ADHD. And I want to say, as I introduce him, that it's going to be really interesting to see how the establishment within which he works responds to his taking these issues on. Michael Corrigan, welcome to the show.
Well, it's great to be here, and I appreciate you having me on.
Does my description sound accurate?
Sounds a lot better to me than I normally get, so I really appreciate it.
Well, you've written a really good book, Debunking ADHD, and people will be able to get it very soon on Amazon and elsewhere, right?
Yeah, they can order today. I was told it came hit the shelves yesterday at the publishers.
Am I your first radio interview?
On this book, you are. You are my inaugural kickoff.
That's fabulous. Praise you and Ginger for getting together. Because, folks, most of the people on this show, Ginger does the connecting with the... And even if they're good friends of mine, and I have not met Michael, we have had a good talk on the phone, Ginger makes these connections, and she just got to you, and you got to her right away. Do you want to start off and talk some about your book? And I'd love to see you address your very establishment-looking decades of work and how that connects to this. But tell us about your book.
I'd be glad to. Well, you know, I've been researching schools for you know, quite a while now, as you said, and a lot of it's federal grant funded research, and my consulting company, we do a lot of work on contract with districts throughout the country. But what we've been studying, you know, often is how does like social emotional character development relate to academic achievement. We've studied how certain language arts are being effective. We've studied second language learning. We've done some really neat studies with UCI Irvine and in the process of another one looking at how to bring science to life. So I've done a bunch of research there. It all kind of started with me. I had a great opportunity through a friend I knew that got me hooked up with the Department of Justice funding to study community engagement or attachment to kids and how it relates to their behavior and success. So I've been, from a psychology side, I'm not a clinical psychologist. I don't know if I have the patience to be that. I just decided I'd be a research psychologist, and I love statistics. That sounds boring to people, but I enjoy looking at the numbers and trying to figure out what's going on and trying to use that data to help people. And the reason I stumbled onto ADHD was I was actually in a rural school, elementary school one time. I talk about this story in my book because it really kicked off why I wrote the book. And I was in there studying these kids in the middle of nowhere, you know, in Appalachia, far from a lot of large cities. And I'd finished my work late that morning. The principal asked me to stay and have lunch. So I actually got in line, and I picked the longest line. And my line kept growing longer and longer, and me being the responsible adult, I just kept moving to the back, and then I started noticing the other line on the other side of the hall was going straight into the cafeteria, and it seemed to me at least a third, if not half, the kids were in my line. It was going so much slower. I finally get up to the close to going in, and I realize there's a window, and I get to the window, and the nurse kidded with me, and you know, asked me if, you know, Dr. Corrigan, do you have ADHD meds that I need to give you? And I kind of laughed just to save face, and I couldn't believe that I was in a line that long. And I went in to eat, and I sat with...
Now, let's get it, really make it clear to people. Folks, this is a line longer than the other cafeteria lines, and it's the medication line for ADHD. Am I clear?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
Yeah,
how many kids, what kind of kids, what kind of school was this?
It was a small rural elementary school, and I've seen the same situation happen elsewhere, but this one probably was the worst situation I'd seen, and what really made me sad was just sitting at the table with these kids that I was having fun with in line. We were joking around, and suddenly, you know, I just watched them kind of turn into catatonic zombies over the time period and just play with their mashed potatoes, and I left that day so irritated that I went home and...
Michael, I want to keep interrupting because this is so graphic. This is just incredible. So the kids have empty stomachs. They haven't eaten yet. So these drugs, they take the drugs right then and there?
Yeah. What I learned later, and you know this, of course, but, you know, this, it dawned on me. I mean, it was rural Appalachia, so I suppose they were taking the cheaper drugs you had to take throughout the day.
Yes.
I couldn't, you know, it dawned on me later, I wonder how many were on XR, you know, the extended release drugs.
That's right. Because this was how long ago?
It was about probably 6 years ago.
Yeah, so they could have been on extended release, but you're right. I mean, obviously they're not. And it's probably, as you're saying, because they're expensive, so they're getting straight amphetamine or you know, methylphenidate and generic probably. And they take the medicine right then and there or when it, from the and drink the water right then and there?
Yeah, yeah, because I saw the Dixie cups. I, as a joke,
yeah.
I thought I was getting a free cup of bug juice to take in to have with my lunch, but turned out to not be the case.
And then you sit down with the kids, and you can actually, within 15 minutes or so, while you're sitting there, you can see them transformed by the drug.
Yeah, yeah, it was
disgusting. That's reasonable because they have empty stomachs at the time.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, go ahead. I think that's very dramatic. I mean, I've never quite heard such a dramatic story about seeing the transformation, and you could just see the kids lose interest and stop socializing and stuff.
Yeah, and you know, I had a several-hour drive to get home that day. I didn't have to fly out for that trip, and you know, I was there to study how we were doing character development, how we could increase and help character development in the kids to help them do better in school. And I was just thinking to myself that day, you know, how can anything we're doing as a intervention in the school contribute to character development if we're drugging these kids to this level? You know, I didn't have any faith in that school producing much results for the grants at that point.
It is incredibly sad. It's incredibly sad. You go back there now, they probably will be on the extended release drugs.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Yeah, and then nobody will notice the effect of the drugs.
Yeah, but I just that day, my wife's a marriage and family therapist, and I got home that day, and first thing I asked when I walked in the door was where was her, you know, DSM, Diagnostic Statistical Manual, mental disorders, and I looked up the ADHD diagnosis, and I was just like, you've got to be kidding me. These 18 symptoms are what they're using to diagnose kids with. And, you know, I teach child development. I teach learning theory. I teach research methods on, you know, how to develop psychometric tools. That's what I, you know, do a lot with my grants. And I was just appalled that these were the 18. And the more you read, you realize they don't even need any of these symptoms to be labeled ADHD, you know, for all the other, you know, unspecified and other type diagnoses. So I, you know, that was the day I was like, this is a diagnosis of normal. And you know, since that day, we start calling it in my house the all do have disorder. So it just went to show, man. And ever since then, I've been speaking about it, you know, whenever I have opportunities.
What year was that? You said it was about 5 or 6 years ago. I can't.
Yeah, that's when it started.
Yeah.
And that's why I got home, and I just read that more, and I actually called my research assistant that night and said, hey, I want to find some more stuff. Can you get me some things on this? And I just started researching it. And I held off writing the book for years because I was just, you know, it's a sticky situation. You've been doing it for a long time. And I'm like, and as you were saying in the introduction, you said, you know, I go around and consult with schools and, you know, help them gather data to help them do that. So here I am now stepping into a world where I'm kind of disagreeing with I'm absolutely disagreeing with what's going on with the way we approach ADHD. And as I started talking about it, I really started discovering that a lot of people agree with me in the schools, and some don't want to agree, but at the same time, many are like, they're happy that I'm talking about it. So.
Yeah. Now, I can tell you that if you had been doing this 10 years ago, you'd be, you know, really being attacked in the schools once you brought these issues up. There's been a change in the last few years that everywhere I go, there are people really concerned about these issues now on a grassroots level. I think the teachers are going to be the last to really get it because it's so easy for them to drug the kids. But there is a change going on. So you're not meeting violent resistance when you talk about this? Nobody screams and yells at you when you begin to question these drugs among teachers?
Well, there's a few that want to disagree, but I'll be honest. I think the majority of teachers don't agree with it, and they don't want to do it. And that's what I write about in one of the chapters in the book is, you know, I know educational policy well, and unfortunately so many of them are being forced by the legalities of the policy to, you know, if they have an issue, they don't really get to necessarily call home and say, can we work this out? you know, they basically have to go through the system, and the system requires that kid to be diagnosed, that kid to get an IEP, that kid to get a 504 plan. You know, so in a lot of situations.
Take a minute and explain those three terms. Remember, the people listening to this show are not going to be predominantly educators, and let's say have kids in school, they may not know those words. So explain IEP and that stuff for the folks.
Yeah, well, education itself, I think there should be some sort of manual on every acronym they use because they have a lot of them. But an IEP is an individual education plan. And basically, if a child's having issues related to a disability or behavior or things like that, or you know, learning disability or developmental issue, they can get an IEP. And in theory, it's a great thing because it was intended to provide children with, you know, that extra support they need, that extra care they need to get a great education. Unfortunately, in another district, I was on a different grant I was doing, urban district. One of the security guards told me there's tons of IEPs, and he called it the individual escape plan. So as you can see, it's probably being abused in some areas. 504 is pretty similar, but it's a little bit more extreme to a degree where, you know, they have to allow this child to do this, this, and this. So they're, you know, in simple terms, they're just legal classifications to deal with kids, and I hate to say the word deal with, deal with kids that are having behavior.
Oh, so the IEP is kind of the first place the child goes when the child has been designated as having some sort of problem and in need of evaluation. That's a fair estimate. And
yeah, it's fair. And it
usually involves a psychologist, doesn't it? So right away, the school psychologist, the child is getting exposed to the psychiatric mental health system.
Right.
Yeah. And then the other one you mentioned, which I'm not familiar with, is the next level of a category where the child is to be treated more permissively, were you saying? I wasn't quite clear what you were saying.
Well, it's more, and it just depends on what district you're in. Some of them push for the 504 first and the IEP second. It just really depends where you're at, but they're just slightly different in technicalities. Both of them basic. One thing I learned with, like, IEPs and one school I was at, you know, a person that had I think might have had both of those things, ended up beating up a girl. She was a girl. She beat up a girl, ended up injuring a teacher in the fight, and the next day she was back in school because part of the issue was related to her 504 was related to her behavior and anger, and they couldn't kick her out of school for those things.
Yeah, because it declared an illness instead of behavior or something.
Right. So here the teacher was in the hospital, and the student was back in school.
These things become almost kangaroo courts or actual kangaroo courts in which the parent who comes to these meetings, by and large, I believe, or can come to them, is faced with what's going to be done with her child. And if the school is at their wit's end with the child, then it becomes a serious conflict situation between a parent who's probably not used to taking on authority and teachers, maybe an assistant principal will come in, the school psychologist, and it readily turns into a potentially abusive situation. Is that unfair? Characterization. I've been involved in some of these on the phone. I think I've been to one or two of them where the parents just asked me to lend them a little courage and strength.
Yeah, I've been in the same situation. It can get ugly real quick. At the same time, you know, some schools that aren't as controlled by the bureaucracy, they still sit down and say let's figure something out and mm-hmm. try to do something else before we have to do this. So I mean, there's a number of educators not wanting to do it, and I know a lot of counselors and school psychologists I've spoke to. You know, they hate the fact that oftentimes they're forced to do this first, but many of them still want to take the old school approach and, you know, sit down and talk to the child and the parents and see what can you know, take place before these things happen. But unfortunately, so many parents are seeing as this as a good thing to me, and that's one thing I address in the book is it's sad because I think the IDEA, the Individuals Disabilities Education Act, I think stands for.
That's a federal act, folks. That's the federal act under which all of this takes place and under which ADHD is, what, not directly included, but has been administratively included. Is that right?
Yeah, it's falling under. Since it's considered a learning disability by some, it falls under that. But
I interrupted you. I keep wanting folks to be able to stay in the flow of the conversation because they don't know these terms. Even if you say it's an act, they're not necessarily going to know that this is a highly politicized, act by which, to a great extent, children have come under the purview of the mental health group too, and end up getting drugged.
Yeah, and I agree. And the reason I bring it up is I think it's a great act, and I think its initial intentions are wonderful still today. That we give these children with handicaps, with disabilities, the chance to really get a great education. Unfortunately, you're now having 6.5 million kids in America, with ADHD, and when you add that many kids for that, and then you add a bunch more for said whatever behavioral disorders. Suddenly what used to be just behavior problems the principal handled, suddenly now, all those millions have to be a part of this IDEA. And to me, it's taking away from what we could be providing kids that really, really have, major learning and disabilities and different things, handicapping them.
Yeah, and it also provides a way, from my viewpoint, of instead of improving the classroom to be more exciting and interesting and individualized and take some of our best and brightest kids who get labeled and instead teach them and excite them and interest them, instead we shove them off into these different categories and ultimately even into different classrooms.
Yeah, and if you get a chance to read more of my research at some point, I've been very outspoken about the testing focus that we have. If you read the Multidimensional Education book with Corwin or the Handbook of Pro-Social Education with Roman and Littlefield, that's what me and my colleagues are really trying to get educators back to the ability to do that. Many of them want to do that. So many of them are tired of the curriculum-driven, tested-driven approach, and they just want to get back. That's why they got into the profession, was to inspire young minds and be that teacher they dreamed of being. And unfortunately, many of them become robots of the system. So, and that's what I stress constantly when I'm working with schools. We've studied 8 dimensions. We don't really care about achievement because focusing on curriculum is not increasing achievement scores. Changing the test to make it easier is not increasing achievement scores. But we know that good teachers that inspire kids and help them love the subject, good teachers and principals and administrators that help kids love being at that school and feeling safe at that school, that's when they thrive in that school academically and socially. So that's what I stress throughout the book is it really comes down to, I really don't think ADHD and the majority, 99% of the cases, is a mental disorder that's in the child's brain. I think it's a problem that's being impacted by the environment they're in, either in the school or the home. And it's not them that needs to change, or it's not them that need to take drugs. It's us adults that need to, fight for the ability to go get back to education that's meaningful and enjoyable and maybe even a little recess and more recess and creative time, because we're taking away art, we're taking away phys ed, we've taken away so many things that kids like myself, that was the reason I went to school when I was younger.
Yeah. Now, you suggested something that I think is really important, that somehow there's a link between this testing and why maybe we're shoving these kids onto drugs and into categories. Is there a link there between this huge movement to test, to supposedly bring kids up to a certain standard, and intolerance of the behavior or making our classes more boring?
I'm sure the drugs don't help it get any less boring. Or though I hear it, it's supposed to make them be more interested in that one topic. I think it, if you read up on it, you'll find that schools actually more, and it was worse historically. It's getting a little better, but we have title monies that we give schools that have kids with disabilities, and the more kids you have with disabilities and low SES, a socioeconomic status, and all these things that challenge the school and providing that good education, they get title money. So to some degree, historically, we've given monies to schools that have more kids diagnosed with learning disabilities. So some have argued that, you know, basically when we have a disability like ADHD, you know, it's there's an incentive there because you're going to get more money if you get this child that's having problems, you know, labeled as a disability, with a disability. The other thing it does is when it comes to testing, and this has changed, a lot of this is changing because we're going from No Child Left Behind to the Common Core test, which will only make our scores uglier over the next 3 years. But in the past, what they've allowed those kids to do is, you know, as long as if they stayed at a certain level of proficiency on the test and didn't fall, you know, didn't get within two years behind, then they got special accommodations when they took the test. So to some degree, you know, given the fact that schools and teachers unfortunately are held accountable for an achievement score that truly only measures, you know, IQ, which we know we can't really change that much, you know, it should be a normal distribution of scores we're looking at every year, but these teachers are being expected to increase that normal distribution into a tsunami wave, you know, that bell curve, and turn it into something different. They're being held accountable for this. So to some degree, I understand the game that many have to play just to keep the doors open and keep their jobs, you know. So there is a connection between testing and drugs. And have you ever seen that video, what's his name, the Changing the Paradigm of Education. I'm blanking on his last name, Robinson. He has a thing on there and just shows how basically the ADHD diagnosis has gone up at the same level that achievement testing has started. So when that started, that's when we started seeing that major increase in ADHD.
No, I've not heard that before. That's interesting information. And you can see why I hadn't really made the connection before about why teachers would like it. If the kid gets an ADHD diagnosis, then he can take a test untimed. He begins to look like a better student on the statistical accounting system.
Yeah, to some degree. And some of them hate it, you know. Some of the teachers hate that.
Yeah. Well, this is very important information, and I haven't had somebody who's just, you know, purely and really an educator like you are on the show in quite a while, and I really, really want to see if maybe in the next segment, the second half of the show, we could talk more and just draw more on your knowledge about the educational system and about what needs to be done. Because, you know, to a huge extent, ultimately, that the educational system is becoming the front line for rescuing children, not just educating them. It's a really complicated problem. And also the difference between what goes on in the poverty schools of, say, the inner cities of America and West Virginia, where you're from, and the difference between what's going on in our suburban schools. It's my understanding that a lot of the lagging that America does in all areas in education in comparison to other countries is largely a measure of including the areas of poverty and particularly the urban centers. Is that correct, Michael?
Yeah, so like China and Singapore, when they met, it's PISA, P-I-S-A is the international test they take. So when they take the test, they've already, you know, weeded out, so to speak, the people that aren't going to college. Those 15-year-olds taking the test in their country are going to college. It's their best students. When our 15-year-olds take the test, it's everybody.
Oh, that's dramatic. That's a scam when we see these lists, America's 22nd, do this and that. It's just faked on the basis of this different populations being tested, all of our population and the best of theirs?
Yeah, it seems unfair, but at the same time, we're supposed to be an education system that's providing a quality education to all folks, you know,
right,
rich or poor. So it still shows what's taking place, and it still shows us that we need to do a lot more to help these, you know, districts that are in these low socioeconomic status areas. So, you know, if we really want to look at fair rankings, then yeah, it's extremely unfair.
Let's talk about that when we come back. Some more about the rankings, because I just brought that up, and because I've never heard it discussed before very openly. And I'd like to, I know your view on it's a little different than mine. I'd like to hear your view more about the rankings issue, but in particular about what we need in this country to really get our educational system going. And I'm not sure how we can ignore the issue of the family in America. I think we have to deal with that too. Let's go to break. Bring on the music, Giselle, and we'll be back with Michael Corrigan. His new book is Debunking ADHD. It's really a good introduction for people who really don't know a lot about the subject. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and of course I'm a psychiatrist. I'm in practice up in Ithaca, New York. I rarely identify myself very much on this show. Really can't assume you all know who I am who are listening, but I assume most of you do. My guest today, a very informed person in the field of education, Michael W. Corrigan. He is a professor at Marshall University, and he's got a new book out, Debunking ADHD, 10 Reasons to Stop Drugging Kids for Acting Like Kids. It's written in a very accessible style. It's a good book. Michael, I think you said that some of your, when we were chatting, that in part you got started in this direction by reading some of my work.
Yeah, when I got back that night from another presentation that I'd done about a year after that incident at that elementary school. It started me down the path. I was talking about it at a district, and a counselor came up to me, and she said, obviously, you've been very influenced by Dr. Peter Bregan. To be honest with you,
I said, who's he?
I didn't act stupid. I wrote down your name and Googled it when I got home that night and ordered your Ritalin fact book. And I read it cover to cover and called one of my research assistants, and I said, I want every one of those guys' journals, publications, and here's these other citations from the book I want you to find. So you gave me a lot of, I was a little worried about writing this book because you're putting yourself out there for a lot of folks to disagree. But just everything I kept reading of yours, and colleagues of yours that have done similar things over the last few decades, I was just like, you know, it's time someone writes a book for parents to understand. Because I love your work, but I'm a scientist. I do statistics. So when you start talking your language, I'm like, oh, my God, yeah, that's great. But I know there's some parents that just get overwhelmed, and even educators get overwhelmed when it's one study after another. So I've really tried to simplify. I used research to show it, but I've tried to simplify it and put it in terms that, you know, all of us can understand. And that's what I've tried to do, is connect your work and work in education and work from child development theory. And, you know, one other thing, when we get to it, if we get a chance to get to it, I'd love to talk about, I just went through in one chapter and said, here's why what's wrong with all the research supporting ADHD, because from a statistical and measurement perspective, from methodology, there's just so many flaws that, you know, they're citing these articles that they're acting like is fact. They're citing it 300, you know, 1,000 times, like, here's evidence, you know, it's genetic, and it's one of the worst genetic studies I've ever seen, you know.
Would you like to launch into that? I was going to ask you what you wanted to launch into. I was sort of outlining my own thinking, but where would you like to go? You want to talk about the ADHD research?
Yeah, I can talk about that, and I don't mind coming back to education and parents' role. I mean, I can address that, and we can come back to it. But The thing I've tried to point out, it's in chapter 6 of the book, is, you know, there's research out there that wants to show these brain scans, and as you've seen, and it hasn't improved that much. Those brain scan studies are such small samples, and oftentimes it's kind of, you know, looking at, if you think about a fitness magazine, it's the after picture rather than the before picture. So it's brain scans of kids that have been on drugs, not kids that are ADHD. And it's just, there's, you know, and I like neuroscience. I think it's amazing. I think it's going to inform us greatly in the future. But right now, it's just it's just not enough to be used as evidence. And the genetic research, the strongest stuff they have, you know, they've discovered that, 11-14% of the kids have some sort of, you know, chromosome that looks, you know, weird, and to me, and then they try to say, well, this is evidence that it's genetic. Well, to me, that's like saying, you know, 14% of kids with ADHD have red hair, and therefore, if you have red hair, it must be your ADHD. My son has red hair, by the way. Okay. So I don't buy that as well. But the majority of the stuff, It they want to show that in the research that they do, and you know as well as I do, the research is being on the pro ADHD side is being performed by people that are on the payroll of the pharmaceutical companies, or they've been hired by, you know, Madison Avenue marketing firms to do ghostwriting their unemployed assistant professors or whatever, and they're great people, but for whatever reasons, you know, they've had to do this research, and I highlight a lady in there who was in a situation, she took it, and then she had to walk away because she had two kids at home who she, you know, believed were ADHD, and what they were wanting her to publish was completely wrong. But what struck me as the worst part of the research on ADHD is that in all these studies where they try to show that this drug had this effect on ADHD, what they fail to point out, and I can't understand how they're getting published, is that they don't have a reliable, valid test. They don't have any medical test or biological test. They have no real statistical, you know, ways to show that one, ADHD existed, you know, that they actually have a test. And they state this, you know, in nearly everything you read, there is no test for ADHD. Well, if you don't have a test in a study where you're trying to do statistics to show that what you're studying actually existed, to show that this disorder, you know, decreased or increased, if you don't have a statistical way to assess that, then you can't really publish the statistical analysis. You know, and any of my, you know, dozen or more publications that I have in peer-reviewed journals, I would have never got them published if I didn't use reliable and valid scales. And it just, to me, that's where we have to just discredit all that. If there's no test for ADHD, then how do we document that these kids actually improved? And what we found is it's based on, they asked some teachers or parents, did the symptoms get better, and then they put a random number to it. Every study I read, I was like, if I, you know, and I've been a reviewer on a number of journals, I was like, I would have never approved this to be published. So, you know, I took a lot of time to read through all the research. Yeah, I focus on education, but I also focus on child development. And to me, I mean, when we publish research in child development, we have to, rule number one, use reliable and valid assessments. That doesn't exist for any ADHD research right now.
It doesn't exist for psychiatry. I mean, everything you're saying,
true,
is all about psychiatry. You go into the psychiatry journals, and what's published is sheer junk. And the only reason it gets published is it supports the psychiatric pharmaceutical paradigm, but it's absolute junk.
Yeah,
and,
evidence-based therapy, right?
There's no evidence at all for the whole system, including the drug approval process, is entirely unscientific. And it has to be that way because science undermines the whole concept of biological psychiatry, which is what all my books are about, is the undermining of biological psychiatry by a genuine scientific examination of human life and human suffering and human struggle. It does not fit that model. It's an irrelevant model. So to make it work, you have to have liars, cheats, frauds, and tons of money.
Yeah, and to some degree, I mean, I think research can inform what we're doing. I don't think we should ever stop researching, but my problem comes in when we try to say, you know, this is evidence, this is proof. I never use the P word or the C word, as I explained in my research methods grad classes, and they always look at me like I'm weird, and the P word is prove, and the C word is cause, because, you know, whenever we think we've found the cause or we've proven something, we're always debunked and turned over. So, I mean, I think we should be using the research to inform us, but we should be using all the research to inform us. And some of the studies I came across that you cited, and I found even more, but, like, you know, they were funded by the NIMH, you know, National Institute of Mental Health, and they found that here's what the drugs did to lab animals and monkeys and all this stuff. And then they turn around and fund, you know, 8-year longitudinal studies, the multimodal studies, the MTA studies, right? And they ignore all the research that said these drugs caused brain damage. And now they say, well, these drugs help improve behaviors, you know.
Yeah. And the latest from the MTA is, however...
Oh, yeah, they didn't find good stuff.
They couldn't prove long-term effects. Folks, what they did was they got together sort of a last hurrah of all the great old boy club for ADHD, guys like Connors, and just from all over the country at a whole bunch of universities. Everybody damn near as old as me or older who'd been making money, and they just wanted to give them their retirement. And they did this longitudinal study on hundreds of children, and all they really ended up showing was what, you know, I'd been saying years and years earlier, which is the drugs stunt height and weight, and they don't do any good. So it's quite bizarre, and it's had absolutely no effect on practice. Psychiatry, the use of psychiatric drugs, is not driven by science, period. Period. It's driven by ideology and drug company money and psychiatric authority. It's really a sad state of affairs. I don't know if those... I'm not sure that you go to that far with those kinds of conclusions, Michael, as I do. And you don't have to, obviously.
Oh, I don't think drugs are the answer for psychiatric problems. You know, I think... And even the MTA say, to their credit, at least in this MTA study, they came out and said... You know, we failed to show that continued use of medication is you know, effective. And what they found was that the kids that were on the drugs after a 41% increase in dosage over those 8 years, you know, were not any better than the kids that just went through therapy, you know.
Well, who just went through a few-week period at a summer camp.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So,
I mean, it wasn't like we were comparing it to extensive therapy. They were no better than any of the other kids in the study, as I remember.
Not at all, and they had worse outcomes when it came to some sort of behaviors and stuff.
There were kids in the study who, you know, were getting nothing. There were kids who were going to camp. There was kids who were getting behavioral stuff.
But I was just surprised at the end to see that they admitted that it didn't. I was actually pleased to see. Well, it was the first real longitudinal study that they had good comparative groups to go on. Two, they didn't have an assessment as if the kids really had ADHD and to what degree it actually fell, but they don't address that because reliability and validity is not important. But at least they showed that, you know, here's what's happened. Yeah. But
it won't get any promotion. We're talking about it, but that MTA study, I want my listeners to know, was used time and again in its first few years to tout the effectiveness of these drugs. And when we had the big ADHD conference in the 1980s, they cited their unpublished data to contradict me. We now have no unpublished data, Dr. Bregan. Where is the data? Why do you bring up data at a conference? You can't show us a paper. And, of course, it was just used and used, and now you're not going to hear much. There's not going to be any big newspaper studies on the failure. Parents aren't going to hear about it. Pediatricians aren't going to hear about it. The whole process is so manipulated. But back to you, Michael. We have 10 minutes. Actually, we have less than 10 minutes. We have, let's focus on some things you want to be sure you get to talk about.
Well, I'm sitting here smiling because I've read so much of your stuff. It's just fun to sit here to be on the phone with you and
thank you.
Hear how you think. And you know, there's times I've read your book and I'm like, oh, I wouldn't go that far.
I'm sure.
But then I'm like, yes, you know, yes, yes, yes. So it's good to be here with you. But I, you know, what you brought up earlier about education and parents, and you were asking about, you know, different drugs and you know, how it relates to those scores. You know, I just find it funny that you know, 30 years ago when we started this war on drugs, you know, First Lady Nancy Reagan urged all of us to say no to drugs, you know, during my days in the 80s. And, you know, now we have nearly 4.5 million parents, you know, feeding drugs to their kids before they go to school. And what we're doing now is just, it seems contradictory to where we were, you know, 30 years ago. And what's interesting, we were talking about the PISA scores earlier, the Program for International Student Assessment is what that stands for. It's a test of 15-year-olds worldwide in the, you know, industrial countries that take part. And these folks take a standardized test on math and reading and critical thinking and all that stuff. What was interesting, they did a study recently, and they went out, and they were trying to figure out, okay, so these countries that are doing so much better than us, than other countries, what are they doing differently? And then they also went to countries that maybe weren't scoring as high, but they still had high-scoring students, right? And they went and interviewed students in those countries. And guess what they found out was the biggest predictor of achievement after controlling for that socioeconomic status factor?
I would think parental involvement.
You are completely correct.
Well, I guess, or I knew, or understood, or something.
Yeah. So they found that, you know, parent involvement was what helped it. No matter how poor you were, if you had a parent that cared about school, that asked you how your day was, that sat down and discussed politics, or you know how, you know, a movie or the news or whatever, a parent that, you know, was active, parents that read to their kids when they were younger on a regular basis, you know, those kids scored so much higher, statistically significant, more higher than the other kids. And what I've written about in Multidimensional Education, the Handbook of Pro-Social Ed, and in this book as well, this is what I'm stressing throughout is, you know, I mean, my wife and I have at times, you know, wanted to blame a teacher for certain behavioral or, you know, educational challenges with our kids, but at the end of the day, we're the ones raising the kids. We've had them for all these years. You know, they've had them for 1 month, you know, 4 months, 6 months. You know, the responsibility rests on us to really help give those kids the tools they need to make the right decisions and do the right things. And that's what the study with PISA found is, you know, these parents were spending more quality time with their kids and helping them develop these tools to think more clearly, to think, you know, smarter, healthier. And that's, you know, that's to me what I'm trying to do is, beginning of the book, I'm just trying to show folks, here's what's going on and here's how we're being fooled. And the last, second part of my book, I'm just showing, here's what happens in child development. These behaviors you see are often related to a developmental delay. They're often just annoying behaviors we see with children. I also touch in the book how basically the symptoms we use for ADHD are very similar to the behaviors we use to identify gifted children. So I have a little story in there about what if we drugged Da Vinci, you know, what if the parents of Da Vinci drugged him? Because we might be drugging our best and brightest kids, and it really comes down to, you know, parenting is, you know, I think teaching is an extremely hard job. I get mad when I hear folks say they're getting paid too much, they get too much time off. Anybody who thinks that way, I suggest you go try to spend a day in a classroom with 20 to 45 kids and get them to focus all day long on, you know, four subjects they really don't want to learn any more about. Parenting is that much more difficult to me and to all of us because, you know, you can read as many books as you want, but none of our kids come with an operating manual and you know, there's going to be things we were never prepared for. So I just really have tried to write the book with a sincere, you know, empathic voice, just I fully understand what parents are going through, and I see the allure of a quick fix and a drug, but it's just not worth the dangers of what comes with the drugs. And I'm just trying to urge so many more parents and educators, you know, it all comes down to that sincere empathy of caring for your child. And someone beat me up recently because I said it's, you know, love is what they need. But that's where I've been kind of going with my talks with folks that want to disagree with me. I just think kids just need more time with us and more time to develop.
Well, I think that what you just said summarizes the whole issue of human life, that we're all about family, and we develop, for the better or worse, in a context of family. Lots of folks rise above the difficulties in their families, but there's always a cost and a toll for that. And the families that pay the most attention to their children are going to have the kids who are doing the best in general. Lots of exceptions here and there, but it is all about family. And family is about love. Family is about connecting. And from the time we're born, what we're the most in need of, in addition to food and water, is being held and loved and connected to. And if we're raised in a German family, we're going to speak German. And if we're raised in an American family, we're going to speak American English. And we're going to be the kinds of people in a very important way that our families made us or failed to make us. And then we got to struggle with that. There's just nothing more important than us as parents. And teachers can help a lot with that. But again, the teachers who are going to matter the most are not the most clever or the best educated. They're going to be the ones who can connect with a child and make that child feel worthwhile and maybe even inspired. It's all about our relationships. You and I think, are in total 100% agreement on that.
I agree. There's a great study called the Pygmalion Effect, and I urge folks to take a look at that. It's all about, you know, teachers being told that some kids in the class, you know, simplified story of it is, you know, they were told these kids in the class are late bloomers and the focus, you know, you don't have to focus on them, but these kids are going to be wonderful kids. And those teachers heard that and they naturally focused on supporting those kids because they were now told those kids were going to be wonderful. And that's one thing we've tried to do in our character education grants is to say, you know, maybe not all of them are going to be Albert Einstein, but all of them can be a great community member, a great parent, a great father, a great person. And that's what we have to look at each kid as, is as someone who can go out and do wonderful things. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of educators want to do that. I think so many of them would just love for what we have right now to be, you know, radically changed when it comes to education policy, so they could go out and do that.
My friend Howie Glasser, who developed the nurtured heart approach to children.
Right.
You know, he. You know Howie? Have you met him?
No, I've read.
Read some of his stuff. Well, he's a good friend. And Howie talks about just bringing out the greatness in a child. What is that child's greatness? What is your greatness, Timmy? And helping mom and dad and teachers bring out the wonderful in children. This is not silly talk. This is not pie-eyed romanticism or something. This is the absolute truth. We've got to bring out the wonderfulness in our kids, give them the opportunity to express it and find it. And it's not about diagnosing them or drugging them or doing special things to them. All kids need the same thing. They need a lot of us. I don't think it differs. And, you know, if you're on one end of the spectrum with an autistically labeled child who's unable to relate, what does that child need? More of what all the other kids need. It's that simple. It's a very simple formula for what is basically going on in childhood and family and what our kids need. And I gather we're on a similar vein there.
We are indeed.
I think, do I hear the music starting already?
Yes.
Well, it's not quite the end of the show, but we must be getting there. I can't instant message with Giselle, and he can't say to me 1 minute to go, but we're getting close to the end. I really, really want to thank you for being on the show. His name is Michael W. Corrigan. His book is Debunking ADHD, 10 Reasons to Stop Drugging Kids for Acting Like Kids. I wish you lots of luck with that book, and let's stay in touch.
I appreciate it, sir.
I hope you've enjoyed the conversation as much as I have. Parting words, sir.
Just keep doing what you're doing.
Those are words for me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You make me stronger.
Thank you. And folks, thanks for listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.